you've got to figure out what can you actually do that will help this student, this kid, figure out where they want to go and then get them there.
I am unwilling to give up, that I will start over from scratch as many times as it takes to get where I want to be.
You just want to make sure you will get knocked down, but just make sure you don't get knocked out.
So your only choice should be go focus on what you can control.
Hi, everyone, and welcome to the Kara Golden Show. Join me each week for inspiring conversations with some of the world's greatest leaders. We'll talk with founders, entrepreneurs, CEOs, and really some of the most interesting people of our time. Can't wait to get started. Let's go. Hi, everyone. It's Kara Golden from The Kara Golden Show, and I'm so excited to have my next guest here. We have Kate Eberle Walker, who is the Chief Executive Officer of Presence Learning. We'll talk a little bit more about her company and how just everything that she's doing around online special education, teletherapy for K through 12 schools. I'm so interested in this topic. But Kate also recently wrote a book that is so incredible. It's called The Good Boss, 9 Ways Every Manager Can Support Women at Work. And it is just an incredible book. It came out in March of this year. Another pandemic book that it was, people were coming out of the pandemic, but definitely have my own appreciation for that whole period of time. That was a first for so many of us, a first book, a first time in launching during a pandemic. So we did it. We made it through for sure. So, and Kate has also been named a champion of equity by the American Consortium for Equity in Education and named top 25 women in PE-backed software companies 2020. An amazing, amazing individual. And Kate, welcome. Excited to have you here.
Thanks, Kara. Thank you for having me.
Very excited. So tell me a little bit more about who was early Kate way back when? I mean, did you know that you were going to be running this incredible company, but also just overall what you wanted to do?
So, well, I think the key thing to know about early Kate is that I'm a middle child. So I think middle children are very obsessed with birth order, and you know, we see things in reference to what someone else is getting. So, you know, I was always looking at, you know, what my little sister was getting, what my older brother was getting, and looking for, you know, sort of my angle in to, you know, to have impact on the family. And so I think that drove me. I wouldn't say that I knew that I would end up one day running something, but I was always trying to figure out like, well, what's my way to actually matter here and actually have an impact? And that came out in probably misguided ways when I was younger. There's this story that my family loves to tell about when we were young. So we'd go visit my grandmother every summer. It was me, my brother, my sister, and one other cousin, another girl. And my grandma would get these little gifts for us, and it would rotate who got like first pick on the gifts. And so the summer that it was my pick, the four gifts, they were coloring books. And you know, so there was one for a boy because of my brother and three girl ones. So it was like Care Bears, Barbie, Transformers, and you know, Strawberry Shortcake. And so I got my first pick and I grabbed the Transformers coloring book. And everyone kind of freaked out and was like, give that to your brother. That's not for you, Katie. I was Katie back then. And I was like, oh, I'm sorry. Cause I thought I had the first choice. And you know, I just very stubbornly felt like, well, if I'm going to make my first pick count for anything, it has to be the one that has, you know, this value. So that was kind of how I made my way through younger life, was trying to figure out like what had value to other people. Fortunately, I grew up a little bit along the way and realized that there were ways to create value that didn't come at the expense of others.
That's hysterical.
I adapted as I got older.
I understand the middle kid. I am not a middle kid. I'm the youngest of five, but I'm married to a middle kid who is very aware of and tells, I have four children with him, and he's constantly talking about the birth order, and you are 1,000% right.
It's, right. Well, you know, more middle children like to remind you that there are, that more middle children become CEOs.
Oh, interesting. Very, very interesting. Well, he is, as he identifies as a struggling, a lawyer that didn't really want to be a lawyer. So then he turned chief operating officer. So he's definitely had some different gigs, but it all goes back to this middle kid that, you know, trying to figure out exactly what he's supposed to be doing and sticking up for himself along the way. Anyway, so funny. And so one of the roles, I guess, that a few different roles, even before starting where you are today, is you were the CEO of the Princeton Review.
Yes.
I mean, crazy. So tell me a little bit about that journey.
Yeah. So I worked a lot of my earlier career in college admissions and test prep. Actually, my first big job out of business school was with Kaplan. So I'm one of the few people to have, ultimately had career success at these two great rivals, Kaplan and Princeton Review. But I worked at Kaplan for nearly a decade on M&A, so buying education companies. I bought over 70 different education companies over my years at Kaplan, and you really studied the industry and, you know, over those years formed stronger and stronger opinions, I'd say, about what makes for a good business in education and what kind of a business, you know, do I believe in and want to run. So it got to a point for me where I was no longer satisfied being the deal person, you know, putting things together and envisioning plans for others to go execute. I wanted to go do it and go try it. And I had this incredible opportunity to go work for IAC, Barry Diller's company. Mm-hmm. They had bought Tutor.com and were thinking about a consumer education online play and what they wanted to build, how they wanted to build it. And they wanted somebody that had experience in the industry. So they brought me onto their team and we envisioned this consumer offering built off of the online on-demand concept of Tutor.com, but expanding into other areas of college admissions and college advice. And we thought, what better brand to do that with than the Princeton Review, which is so storied and so trusted. So we bought it. And that was my last foray into M&A, was buying Princeton Review. And then I got to go over to the management team and be part of building it out and executing against our plan. I was CFO for the first year running the integration, and then I became CEO.
That's wild. And what did you learn? What was kind of the core thing across all of those companies in education? What were you seeing? I mean, I guess essentially, how many years was this like?
This was like 15 years. Yeah,
15 years. And so did you see this like trend amongst all of these? I guess there's a pool of students, right, that are at different levels. And what was kind of the core thing that you were seeing?
Well, you know, for education, it's tough to run a great education company because you are held responsible for this outcome. I mean, you're not just, you know, giving them a book or, you know, offering them this course. They're counting on you to help them get somewhere. Mm-hmm. So I think the big thing about education, especially college admissions, is you've got to figure out what can you actually do that will help this student, this kid, figure out where they want to go and then get them there. And you're going to, you know, count on them to do a lot of work in the process as well, right? It's you're making a promise that as a company you can't fully keep on your own. You need the buy-in, you need the belief, you need the work from the student. So it all comes together in a way that, you know, I think the companies that do well in that space are the ones that are clear about expectations. They don't overpromise. There's a lot of gaming in the space that can happen about promising these big test score improvements or, you know, 100% admission to Harvard kinds of things. And, you know, I learned over all those years a couple of things. One is that Harvard or any given school, it shouldn't be the end goal for every mm-hmm. kid. It's really about finding the right fit. And then that, you know, you can't promise numbers. You've got to promise success and that you'll help each child figure out what that is for them. So it's an interesting space to be in. You've got to really take responsibility for this phase of life and where somebody gets to. Education, you know, education opens up everything for a child.
Yeah, absolutely. And then before we get into your book, I want to talk about your company, Present Learning. Yeah. And I mean, obviously, you're really focused in on the special education side of the world. I mean, did you feel like you learned and became really passionate about that through what you were seeing in these previous roles?
I was so lucky to find Presence Learning. So I came into Presence Learning when the company was about 10 years old, and the investors and the founder were looking to bring in an outside CEO to help mm-hmm. the company scale further. And I wasn't that aware of the company yeah. when I first started talking to them. I'd been having, you know, coffee with an investor friend, as you do. We'd sold Princeton Review, and I was, you know, off to find my next CEO gig. And I was talking to an investor who had a lot of holdings in the education space, and he said, "Well, describe your ideal company to me. Like, what would you ideal if you could invent the company you're going to run next? What would it be?" And I said, "You know, I loved our business model at tutor.com, the idea of using technology to make a really important human service accessible to more kids and affordable for more kids." And, you know, that was what we'd done at tutor.com. We weren't taking the human element out of the education. We were connecting a student to a live tutor, a live teacher. And I loved that. And I loved how we were making that more accessible for kids in the moments when they needed it. So, you know, I started talking about that and saying, you know, I'd love to find another company that does that too. Maybe earlier stage, you know, Princeton Review is a more mature company. I'd love to you know, come in somewhere that really needs me and a team to grow it and bring it to the next level where we can really impact what this company will become. And if it could be in a part of education that's even more meaningful than helping academically successful kids gain admission to college, that would be the icing on the cake. And the investor said, you know, "Oh my God, we have this company in our portfolio and they're just launching a search to bring in an outside CEO. You have to meet them." And that was Presence Learning. So I got to know it through that and came into the company that way. And now I'm 2.5 years into it. And I had no idea how much I needed to learn about the special education part of the market. I mean, for myself, it's actually personally changed my life. I realized once I started spending time with our clinicians, I started recognizing that they could help me with a speech challenge my own daughter had been having that I'd been asking pediatricians and teachers about for years. And, you know, it was sort of minimized as something not to worry about. And within months of having gone to the team at Presence Learning, I had her evaluated, had therapy recommended, and came to appreciate what it is that speech pathologists do and can do for our kids. So it's become a very personally meaningful thing that I feel so lucky to have gotten introduced to them.
Well, they were lucky to find you too, but obviously, I mean, I always feel like every point of our journey is kind of for a reason, right? And mm-hmm. that clearly is what you're describing. So how, I mean, talk to us a little bit about Presence Learning for those people who aren't familiar. How does the system work?
Yeah, so we are a teletherapy platform and software provider for special education services. So we have a team of about 1,600 therapists. We have speech pathologists, occupational therapists, and school psychologists and social workers. And so our team helps schools cover the therapy work and the evaluation work that they need to get done, but can't do because they don't have enough people on staff. So you know, the way special education works in our public education system is it's federally mandated. So if a child is determined to have a disability that requires therapy, the school has to provide it to that student, to that family free of charge. And they want to, they try to, but it's incredibly difficult to recruit these clinicians to come work every day in the school district. It's a hard job. It's really, I mean, it's emotionally taxing. It's physically taxing. It's long hours, heavy caseloads, a lot of driving around. And so a lot of the therapists will do it for, you know, maybe a few years earlier in their career, but then they might go to private practice right. or go work in a clinic. So Presence Learning came along and said, you know, we think we could keep more of these clinicians working with public education students if we offered them a way to work remotely with more flexibility to do their work from home. It's, you know, not coincidentally, this is a very, very female working population. So 97% of speech pathologists are women. And many of them, at the point where they start their own families, decide that they, you know, they can't sustain the hours and the structure of full-time on-site work at a school, but they love working with these kids and they want to continue. So over 80% of our clinicians who work with us online are working mothers of school-age children, and they find their way to us and they get to keep on, you know, using their training and their license and working with these kids in public education, but they can do it on their terms and set their hours. So you know, to us, we're as much about, you know, serving these women and providing them with a career path as we are about supporting these kids and getting them the services. So we do a double good thing.
That's amazing. And so how did that change? I mean, over during COVID, I mean,
oh, everything changed. Yeah. I think, well, the biggest change was just awareness of teletherapy and acceptance of it. So, you know, we went from being something that, you know, we worked with a lot of very rural districts who, you know, just couldn't hire these clinicians, or with a lot of very concentrated urban districts, same thing, had a hard time hiring, retaining. You know, we were helping them solve their problems and their shortages. All of a sudden, you know, we went to having 100% of districts were needing to figure out how to do some of their work online. They were closed for some period of time. And so teletherapy suddenly became a very, you know, relevant mass solution. And so for us as a company, it changed actually our offerings. So we started, you know, we recognized at some point in that spring, or really the winter of 2020, that the, you know, the thing that we could do to help wasn't necessarily going to be to sell more of our services. You know, to keep going around to school districts saying, send us your caseload overload, send us your evaluations and our team will do them. They had a different problem to solve. All of a sudden they had all of their staff were at home. Their kids were at home. They had the established therapy relationships. They just needed to connect with their kids. And so we started doing professional development. We started training the school-based staff on, you know, how do you adapt your on-site practice to an online world? How do you connect with kids? How do you build rapport through the screen, through technology? So we started doing training. We called it Teletherapy 101. You know, we said, okay, we've spent a decade figuring out how to do this well. Let's teach people who are working in these schools who now are being forced to do it, how to do it well. And then we started licensing our therapy platform, our software, so that they would have a tool that had, you know, all of the therapy activities and content and multi-screen views and games and assessments, so that they'd have everything that they needed to be able to deliver the therapy. So we added that whole new business line to our company in the past year, and we've grown like crazy.
That's awesome. I bet there were people even before the pandemic who were saying, I don't know if I want to do it this way. We want a live person. And then once you actually have to do it, it just totally changes. And then obviously the therapists, right, who are, you know, you probably had a lot of people who felt a lot more comfortable.
Yeah. I mean, a lot of them, yeah, they didn't know if it could be done that well or how it would feel to work that way. And they got to experience it. The biggest shift was with parents. And I, this was true in online tutoring, online test preparation, all of that as well. The, when parents see how effective something can be online, and they actually, parents get to see it in a way, they get to actually, you know, witness their child interacting with this professional, it's, it, it tends to be the parents that drive the wave of adoption. And I think that definitely happened for special education therapy over this past year. You had these parents watching these interactions and seeing how their children engaged. And then, and now coming into the next year, we see them, you know, asking for it and requesting it. So I think it'll really change the way that, that this part of education is thought about in terms of online.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I have a friend who is a sixth grade teacher in public school in San Francisco, and hearing her stories of, she was sharing with me a story about how the kids don't actually have to turn on their video when they're in the classroom online. And you know, they didn't go back to school, I guess, this whole year. And so they were doing it all virtually. And then kids would actually get bullied if they turned their video on. And I know, which is heartbreaking. And she said that the kids who actually, you know, had challenges, special education challenges, I mean, it was just, you know, absolutely heartbreaking. So I think that there's definitely, you know, this need where people can interact, right, in these programs and figure out, you know, how do you push through those in case, you know, God forbid we have to do this again, right? And it's, it's definitely... Thank goodness that you guys are doing what you're doing. So, okay. So the book, totally different. I mean, maybe, maybe there's some crossovers in there as well, I'm sure, just on your journey. But the new book came out, which I mentioned, is so good. It's called The Good Boss, and subtitle, 9 Ways Every Manager Can Support Women at Work. But talk to me about The Good Boss. What made you think about writing this book?
So I wrote this book for men, for male managers. So I found especially once I became a CEO, talking to my peers, and you know, let's be honest, but most of our peer CEOs are men. They'd come to me asking for advice when they, you know, about the women who worked for them, about, you know, what should I do? I want to do the right thing. Should I say this? Should I not say this? You know, lots of asks for advice from kind of my male CEO friends. And I, when I heard myself giving advice back, it felt like what I was telling them was just, it was very practical, and it was just rooted in trying to give them more perspective in the real experience that women have in the workplace. And it struck me, there's so much to gain by giving managers a real clear understanding of, you know, this is how women experience the workplace, and this is how it shows up in the data. And so here's what you can do. Here's what you could say. Here's what you shouldn't say. Here's what you can change just in your day-to-day interactions with the women who work for you. Even if you're a manager of one person, you know, it doesn't have to be only CEOs, doesn't have to be only HR leaders who are setting policies and changing things from the top. Anyone who has responsibility as a manager for a woman on their team can, you know, benefit from just listening and gaining that perspective of what's the workplace like for her. So I started trying to write it out. I said, you know, this is a book that I know how to write. You know, I've lived it myself. I've worked my way up and really learned along the way how different it can be when you have a manager who's setting the right tone for you, you know. And I reflected upon those managers for me and what they did, and, you know, how, you know, I really truly wouldn't be where I am if I hadn't, you know, come upon some really incredible bosses along the way. And so I wanted to try to take what they did for me and what other women told me about with their great bosses and turn it into, you know, as much of a formula as we could for what everybody could do to create a more equalized workplace.
So what were, just name a couple of examples. I mean, what did you see as kind of the core thing that you, you know, felt was like number one? I mean, how do you be the most supportive boss in this situation? And honestly, like, I think your book, definitely, it sounds like you wrote it really for so many men that had asked you, but I think it's great for both men and women. I mean, because I think women sometimes feel like they're also watching their career and they're, you know, tackling things as well. How do you continue to be supportive to other women in the environment as well, but also be fair to men too? I think like that's another whole topic, that if you're a female leader, is actually making sure that we're not just supporting the women in the group, but also the guys as well. So
exactly. I think about that a lot as a leader for sure. Yes. So, well, okay. So one core principle that I think is important for everybody, bosses and employees, men and women, is to, you know, to be an authentic person in the workplace, to show who you are, and to be interested in who other people are. And, you know, I felt like that, I mean, that might sound simple, it might sound obvious, but, you know, a lot of times in workplace context, people get hung up on being careful, being professional, not crossing lines. And I think that it can be to a detriment if you aren't, you know, really open and making employees feel like they can be who they are and talk about what they care about outside of work. I mean, why does anybody want to come to work every day if they don't feel like, you know, they're really being themselves, if they don't feel like they like the people that they work with? That's when someone asks me for advice about, you know, how do I know I'm interviewing for a job or I have a job offer, how do I know if this will be a good boss for me? I always start with, well, did you like them? Did you enjoy yourself in the interview, right? And, you know, because if you can't have a fun conversation where you're each engaging and listening to each other, you know, chances are that's not going to be a productive working relationship. You know, your boss should care about what you have to say and should be listening to you. So, and then as a boss, I think that, you know, you do have to extend yourself as much as you're willing. You know, one thing I talk about a lot is I believe in sharing on social media and inviting all of my employees to follow me. I don't force it on them. I don't invite them to be my Facebook friend. I let them know that, you know, they're welcome to follow me and that I share about my life. And many of them do, and they invite me to follow them. And, you know, what you can learn about somebody on Instagram, you know, it shows you what they care about and it shows them what you do. It gives you more connecting points. And that's an area I really advocate for, where I think that leaders can do more and put themselves out there more. Generationally, I think that some of us were maybe came of age in a different time where we were actually taught not to, you know, that, you know, you should draw lines and you shouldn't be on social media, you shouldn't connect with your employees. But surveys of the next generation of workers shows they definitely don't feel that way. Actually, 80% of employees in one survey I looked at said that they would like to be connected with their bosses on social media.
That's so interesting. And I'll be curious to see what Gen Z, they coming up in the, you know, next generation. I have four of those. Mm-hmm. And so I think that they would want to be more connected, you know, with their boss and wanting to know what's going on as well. So that's super, super interested. So you solicited feedback from several CEOs and doing research for the book. What was kind of the most surprising feedback you received from a CEO? Actually, women and men, was there any difference in sort of the
definitely
feedback?
Definitely there were gender differences. I think probably the most surprising thing was not even something that came out in an interview, but in the after editing. So, you know, you interview everybody for your book, and then my publisher had me reach out to each one of the CEOs I'd spoken to get them to sign a release and authorize the use of their section of the book. And so when I did that, I shared with each of them, you know, thanks for the conversation. Here's what I wrote. Here's what I'd like to put in the book. Can you please sign this form and send it back to me? And, you know, to 100%, all of the male CEOs, like within, it felt like it was within seconds, maybe it was within minutes, just responded. Yeah. Like they clearly couldn't have read the passage or even read the release. It was just like, yep, awesome. Thanks for including me. Here you go. And all of the women to 100% read through what I'd written, asked me to change words, asked me, you know, could you say this instead of that? They edited a few rounds what was going to be put in the book for quotes from them. And so I, you know, as I was going through this, I noticed that trend and then reflected on, you know, some of the other ideas and concepts I put in the book about how, about what a burden we as women, I absolutely felt this and still to some extent feel it, this need to edit our and to be careful and to really make sure that we say things in the right way, in the way that will be accepted in the workplace. And I sort of saw that playing out, even with all of these, you know, very strong, powerful women leaders, they felt they need to be thoughtful, careful, like to the vocabulary word, right, about how they were quoted. And, you know, I think that there's some strength in that. I think it's important to be thoughtful about the words you choose and how you speak. But at the same time, there's a whole lot of time and effort that gets put into that, that, you know, men are working on other things while we're editing ourselves. And so that came through in the process in a way that I wasn't necessarily expecting.
That's so interesting. So that would definitely be me. I would be the, you know, person looking at it and looking and not actually giving a response until I had looked through everything. But I think that, that's so interesting that so many people that it was so clear in the genders.
Yeah.
We're getting that feedback as well. So you also discussed new parents returning to the workforce. Mm-hmm. What do you think that looks like in this world of us all trying to figure out going back to work? And how can management really make it easier and engage these parents more?
I think there's some good stuff that will come out of this. I hope. I'm optimistic about this. I think for one, you know, I've talked to a lot of women who had their babies during the pandemic and were working remotely and therefore returned from their maternity leave still working remotely. And that I think was, and felt really great about it. I mean, allowed them to ease back into it. It takes out some of those physical challenges. I could write a book about all of the like stresses I had in my first year back after having my baby about like, you know, pumping and traveling while pumping and all of those things. When you don't have to leave your home for a bit longer of a stretch, I think it actually makes a really big difference in you know, how you can engage more fully when you come back to work. So I think that women are positive on that. I think the other hopefully positive thing is that we've all across genders witnessed more parenting happening, you know, in the background of our Zooms over the past year. So I hope there's some more understanding or recognition that, you know, there are other things going on in people's lives, but it doesn't mean that they're not going to get their work done and that they're not going to be engaged and focused. And, you know, you can be both a parent and a worker. Those two things can be true and coexist. So I hope there's more awareness and recognition of all of that. I think the risk is that, you know, I write about in the book, this thing that happens to women when they return from maternity leave, where, you know, they've been kind of written out of the story and they've got to fight their way back in and insert themselves to get the good projects back, to, you know, get included in meetings again. You know, people sort of prepare for them to be out and then they adapt and are, you know, doing the work and don't necessarily prepare for them to return. And so I wonder about that. Will it be even harder for women to reengage if their managers aren't watching out for that and actually thoughtfully planning for their return and reintegration and, you know, giving them their work back, their assignments back when, you know, you're not all in the same location where you can just, you know, walk into a conference room or where it's very obvious if you're not being invited to a meeting. So I think that's it. For a manager of a woman returning, I think it's more important than ever to follow my direction from the book and really plan for her first day back, her first week back from leave, as a new onboarding, as a new return to work, and make sure that you're engaging her and assume that she wants you to bring on the work. She's not, you know, she doesn't want you to ease her into it and leave her kind of drifting.
Yeah. No, I think that's great advice as well. I frankly worry a lot about the culture of, you know, when you've got some people who are working remotely versus people going back into the office, and then, you know, you layer in the coming back from maternity leave. I think people are, there's this complexity of sort of understanding if people are in the office, if they're not in the office, right? And then the opt-in, I guess, is that, you know, who ends up being, you know, the player, right? In that. And I really do worry about that unless we sort of figure out exactly what that structure is. Having said that, our company, like lots of other companies, did really well with this whole virtual world, right? And so, but I think when you have a hybrid world, which I think most companies are moving into, I think it just, you know, human behavior is that it just gets more complicated, right? And I can't really envision how it's going to work exactly. And I think some people are, somebody was just telling me that Airbnb, I think, decided to not go back in the office until 2022 and until the fall of 2022, like 100%. You have to have special permission to actually even have a meeting in the office. And I thought, gosh, that's really, I wonder why a company that big is doing that. And it sort of led into this conversation that there's, you know, how do you actually manage, how do you, you know, become a great boss versus a mediocre boss when you've got some people that are, you know, within your visibility. I don't know. I'm not saying it can't be done. I think that it's complicated for managers, and there definitely needs to be some teaching along the way for sure.
Yeah, definitely. It definitely is going to take more deliberate action, right? You've got, they're going to, managers are going to have to be thoughtful about it. Another thing that I'm thinking of that I probably hadn't thought about enough was we struggled at my company over this past year with the blurring of the work hours, you know, things kind of, you know, without having commutes to kind of put, you know, guardrails on the day, you know, things stretching a little longer, starting a little earlier, and, or just, you know, moving throughout the day. And that's hard for a lot of people, right? I think everyone benefits from, you know, having some reliability to their day, but, you know, especially new moms, like, I mean, I still remember the stress of like, if I think that I can do a feeding at this time, it's, you know, it builds up a different kind of anxiety if schedules are moving and changing and, you know, you've got to adapt on the fly. So I think that just even the way we think about the workday has gotten looser in perhaps not a healthy way for women.
Yeah, no, I absolutely agree. And I think everybody is ready to move on to this next phase, but I think it's got people, you know, sort of trying to figure out exactly how to not only deal with families, but also deal with how to manage, how to insert yourself into this new environment too. So should definitely pick up this book. It's quite great for whether or not you're a CEO or you're trying to manage people in your company. And then also if you're just really interested in being a terrific manager one day in the future, Kate has done such a great job of laying this out. And I'm so, as I mentioned, I'm so interested in presence learning too. You are, it's terrific what you guys are doing, and it's definitely helping a lot of people. So I love that you're a helper, right? That's on multiple levels. And where's the best place for people to pick up the book and learn more about presence learning?
So presence learning, you can find us at presencelearning.com and reach out whatever you need or your school district needs. The book's available on Amazon, Bookshop, wherever books are sold. And you can find me at, my Instagram is at CEO Author Mom. So if you're interested in following the happenings around the book and events, you can find me there.
That's awesome. That's great. Well, thank you so much, Kate. And everybody, thank you so much for listening. Please give Kate a great 5-star rating and download the podcast. We are here every Monday and Wednesday with very, very cool CEOs, founders, amazing books with many of these CEOs and founders. And of course, pick up a copy of my book if you have not. It's called Undaunted, Overcoming Doubts and Doubters, and maybe even grab a bottle of Hint along the way too. And thank you, everybody. Have a great rest of the week, and we will hopefully get to meet you and hear from you soon. Thanks. Before we sign off, I want to talk to you about fear. People like to talk about fearless leaders, but achieving big goals isn't about fearlessness. Successful leaders recognize their fears and decide to deal with them head on in order to move forward. This is where my new book, Undaunted, comes in. This book is designed for anyone who wants to succeed in the face of fear, overcome doubts, and live a little undaunted. Order your copy today at undauntedthebook.com and learn how to look your doubts and doubters in the eye and achieve your dreams. For a limited time, you'll also receive a free case of Hint Water. Do you have a question for me or want to nominate an innovator to spotlight? Send me a tweet at Kara Golden and let me know. And if you like what you heard, please leave me a review on Apple Podcasts. You can also follow along with me on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and LinkedIn at Kara Golden. Thanks for listening.